Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative and explore whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a range of subjects, and for this, the Arts Hour, I interview guests from all areas of the arts. This week, I'm pleased to be featuring internationally renowned artist and author Enrique Martinez Celaya. This is the second in a series of conversations I had with Enrique at his studio in Los Angeles, in time he set aside between painting and his university teaching commitments. If you missed our first conversation, if you go to the show's website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, and click on Guests, you can find the podcast of our first conversation there. And then be sure to look out for the final conversation airing in coming weeks. Enrique is an award-winning artist who works predominantly in painting, but also in sculpture, photography, poetry, and prose. He trained as an artist as well as a physicist and invented several patented laser devices before abandoning physics for art. His artwork has been widely exhibited internationally and is held in the public collections of international institutions such as the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, the State Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, the Moderna Museet in Stockholm, the Museum der Bildenden Kunst der Leipzig, Germany, and the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, amongst others. Enrique is the author of papers in art, poetry, philosophy, and physics, and several books. Born in Cuba and raised in Spain and Puerto Rico, Enrique began his formal art training at the age of 12 when he became apprenticed to a painter and developed an enduring interest in writing and philosophy during his time in Puerto Rico. He received a Bachelor of Science in Applied Physics and a minor in Electrical Engineering from Cornell University and a Master of Science with a specialization in quantum electronics from the University of California, Berkeley, where he was a Regents Fellow. He attended the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture and earned an MFA with the department's highest distinction from the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he was also a junior fellow at the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center. He's the first person to hold the position of Provost Professor of Humanities and Arts at the University of Southern California, is a Montgomery Fellow at Dartmouth College, and a Fellow of the Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities. And Enrique is committed to the education and formation of artists, and he sponsors programs for children, provides scholarships for artists, and assists schools in developing their curriculum. In 1998, he founded Whale and Star Press, which publishes books on art, poetry, art practice, and critical theory. He's worked in collaboration with scientists, entrepreneurs, writers, musicians, and architects, including the Canadian rock band Cowboy Junkies, the poet and Nobel Prize-winning chemist Roald Hoffman, and the novelist Mary Rakow. His work has also been the subject of several monographic publications. I spoke to Enrique at his studio in Los Angeles, which has multiple high-ceilinged, immense rooms both to paint in and display his work. And the studio also has a small library and a lovely verdant garden featuring some of his sculptures. Well, let's hear some of our conversation. Why did you choose painting as your main form of artistic expression?
I mean, I have a lot of interest, and I did when I was younger. I had a lot of interest in writing, in particular, and science. I was also interested in other things as well. But painting, art in general, and painting in particular, felt very natural to me. Just, it's a cliche to say that they chose me rather than I chose them. But there is some truth to that. you know, like I had no, I love music, but I couldn't, I didn't gravitate towards it and so on, or dance or something. But painting seemed like a natural way for me to relate to the world. I mean, the sense of images, the sense of making something with my hands, all of that. And I don't know where, you know, I could always draw since I was a little kid. Like, I don't know what that is. Perhaps because that was there, then it became a more natural venue. But perhaps it's the other way around, that the reason I could draw is because there was something in me that made me look at the world a certain way and do it. So it's very difficult to know how that comes about.
You might take 2 years to work on a painting. Can you explain some of your practical process, how you're approaching creating a work of art over that kind of time period?
I'm usually going after something, a certain inquiry, something I don't understand well. And because the beginning of the work is sitting on a doubt or is pursuing something that I can barely grasp, then I begin to fumble in my way through the work in search of that. And that elusiveness of the beginning is the reason why it takes me a long time sometimes to get to a painting that seems to be resonant. So the way I work in the process is I paint and repaint and repaint paintings, and I go back to writing, and then I come back to painting, and the whole process of making and destroying, and then going back to writing as a way to bring it all together. May last many iterations. I might make a painting that had 30 paintings in it that were superseded or painted over or you know, eliminated.
Yeah. You've spoken about how part of the tenderness of painting is the knowledge that when you are painting, you know it's ultimately going to fail. I'm wondering what success would encompass if indeed that is the goal of the process.
For me, the possibility of a work of art is the unconcealment of truth, the certain clarification, something transformative that in the process of transforming you, and there's a certain recognition of things. And that is something that happens in a flicker, maybe a quick moment, and then it goes away. And then you have to go back and re-engage it. So I think in many ways, the promise of a work of art to get you to have this clarity is always just out of reach. It is there for a moment and then it disappears. You're sort of revealed, something is revealed or shown for a second, this territory, and then the door closes again. And artwork is really a pointer more than anything towards that direction, rather than putting it there for all time. So I think that's where the failure comes in. I think success for a work of art would be one that somehow managed to wake you up to what is there. And that, rather than a momentary wakefulness and then going back to the slumber of life. So I think that would be what success is, but I don't think it's possible with a work of art.
It's part of that because if we are always growing, then when we revisit a work of art, as part of that inquiry, our new place of growth is going to inform that inquiry in a different way. Do you think that's part of the reason, in a way, it can never be completely finished, or is that something else?
I think that's something else. I mean, I think the wakefulness that I'm speaking about can happen at any time. You can awaken yourself to the world and move sort of all these illusions out of the way at any moment in time, regardless how much knowledge you have or experience. But for the most part, that is not how it comes to be when you read a great book or encounter a great painting, you have a sense of that, or you have a flicker of that, but then it closes, and then it sort of it disappears, and what you're left with is the resonance of that moment, but the moment itself is gone. So in closing, say Moby Dick, and I'm reading that last passage about him being an orphan, you know, you have a sense of the immensity of what is presenting to you, and you feel that you can almost hold it, and for a moment it's there, and then it goes away, and what you're left with is that conclusion of Moby Dick, how it felt to have been so close to something so big. And then you go back to the next book and to the next one. And as a maker, I think what I am after, I guess, I don't know if this is something I can generalize for anybody else, is that recognition, that revelation of that immensity that dissolves oneself, that dissolves the illusion of the I in me and makes me continuous with everything and reveals sort of truth that would never be available otherwise. But it has not been something that I can ever hold, and for more than a brief moment.
How does working with sculpture compare with painting for you? I mean, you predominantly are a painter, but you do both. How is it? How does it compare? Differ?
I mean, sculpture makes exist in your own same space. It takes that presence of painting and makes it very, very much as the end of the experience of sculpture. And I find that is a good counterpoint to painting. I like the sense of sculpture sharing my same world in some manner. And I have made sculptures of many different materials and like to work with, even if it's going to be cast in bronze, to materials that are very difficult to work with, visceral materials. And because of that, sculpture serves a purpose of the object or of the it's a resistance to sometimes the sterility of thought in some manner. When working with sculpture and with the materials, and not in a fetishistic way, but in a way that undermines any facility you have, undermines, you know, if I'm using tar or dirt or something, undermine traditional grace or something.
Yeah.
And because of that, it has a way to short circuit a few things and get to something more direct and raw and sometimes feels more authentic than the polished quality that painting sometimes can have. You know, sculptures can be just a lump in your space, and that the humility of that lump is a good reminder of what may be possible. And I like that about it. I also work in photography occasionally, and I've worked in video and do a lot of works on paper. And part of why I like those things is partly why I like sculpture too, is the fact that I find myself very much an amateur, a beginner in some of these things. And I like the idea that I am not in control of what I'm doing. I don't know a lot of the technical parameters. And because of that, I have the chance to do something less refined, more immediate, that perhaps I might be able to do in painting.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my conversation with special guest, artist and author, Enrique Martinez-Celaya. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
Do you like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland? Have you ever wondered what the Fools songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Ocean's black, but steamer lane. No white horses to play the game. And I wish I knew your name. Something about you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, babe, it just goes nowhere. Well, we can do the things we want. We can do the things we like. But if we're taking all the time, well, I just don't think that it's right. I think that there's more to life than just that. I think that there's more to us than just that.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, artist and author, Enrique Martinez Celaya, whom I spoke to at his studio in Los Angeles. And as I mentioned at the beginning, this is part of a three-part series of conversations I had with Enrique. So if you missed the first one, if you go to the show website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, and go to the guest page, you'll be able to find the podcast there. And then do look out for the last upcoming conversation. But right now, let's hear some more of my talk with Enrique.
How important is the naming of your works to you? With a title, you're giving the observer some indication where to go, and sometimes titles are quite enigmatic. What do you consider when naming a work?
Well, for the last 15 years, all my names have the article in the beginning. So, you know, so the discovery or something like that, which makes it very specific, a specific pointer to something that, almost like you're pointing in a map to a larger territory, and as if the work was revealing aspect of a large, vast landscape, which required that specificity. So that's the first thing I consider in naming the works. And sometimes the titles emerge naturally in the process of working. Sometimes it comes from my writings. You'd always have to be a title that thus is revealed or unconcealed by the work, or vice versa, that by putting that title, something gets revealed about the work, although not always in a supportive sense. Sometimes, as you said, it could be enigmatic or sometimes contradictory to what appears to be a place. And then I like to think of the two of them together, the title and the work, as an inseparable pair. That the friction between them is what is really creating the meaning, rather than just the meanings in the work and the title is just like a cataloging data or something.
Right, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think for most people looking at art, when there's the title is Untitled 3 or something, it's always a bit dissatisfying when you're looking at a work of art. But then the other extreme of that is a sort of precious naming of things where it's almost seems to have no relation, and somebody's just called something something to make it more than it really is. So I think it's...
like the impossibility of death in the mind of the living, which is Damien Hirst's name for his frozen shark. So that is a way
don't get me naming first.
That's a way to give it a tremendous gravitas to something that probably requires less fanfare.
Yes, no, I completely agree. On commercial talk radio, there are a lot of talking heads. There's a lot of people with very strong opinions proselytizing. And my aim with my show from the beginning has been to make people think, not to tell them what to think. And I'm wondering if that's a differentiation that you see between different kinds of art. I mean, this kind of segues into Damien Hirst, but some art just telling you what to think. And some art making you think. And I'm wondering where you see that work, your work on the spectrum. I mean, I'm assuming that you are looking for your work to make people think, but maybe that's not how you think about it when you're creating it. Maybe think is the wrong word as well.
Well, I am creating my work as an inquiry, so I can understand something better. And then the hope is that that inquiry will serve someone else. But the work is never created in a thought-provoking manner, like I know something, which then I'm going to put out to the world for the world to think something, like consciousness-raising type of thinking.
Right.
I find that not only distasteful, but quite arrogant. Mm. So my work, I only create work because I don't understand things well enough. And the work is my way to try to aim at a better understanding. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the work is both a testimony of that inquiry as well as the pointer towards some discovery. Mm. So I'm hoping that there's someone out there who will see the work and some of that will happen for that person. Mm. But thinking itself and as such, I mean, I find when there's a lot of thinking, like recently, all these art people may be criticizing a political condition, and yet at the same time, we'll be celebrating the heavy thought of someone like Ai Weiwei. I find it to be very crude way of thinking, that this thing that I can understand generates this thing that I can understand, and therefore generates this thing that I can understand. And all of that, I find it to be kind of a relatively pedestrian and immature idea of what the connections and deep insights that art can produce are. I mean, they're really, it's trivializing the process of art in such a way, just because the implied statements and the implied ideologies are respectable and respected, does not necessarily mean that the work itself is respectable. Mm. That just because you have, great intentions and good ideas does not in itself make an artwork be transformative in any way whatsoever. Mm. And in fact, it's predictable. And quite often, as time passes, when we look now at an 18th century work, we no longer have an urgency with the ideas that were presented then, and what we're left are with whatever else was cooked into the work, as for example the Disasters of War by Goya. I mean, you can look at those works and you don't necessarily think of the Napoleonic Wars. You just think about something about the human condition, And those things are there because Goya was able to put that into the work.
Yeah.
But the specific political conditions of that moment are lost to us, and they don't have any urgency. Nobody feels anything for non-Napoleonic Wars, but you feel something for that individual suffering.
Yes. Yeah. I've just been revisiting the Blau writer recently, and I think, you know, Franz Marc and Kandinsky talk about that a lot, how, you know, real works of art are timeless in that sense, and also that, I forget how Franz Marc puts it exactly, but works of art that are created from a really truthful place stand with each other regardless of the form of the art. And I think that's somewhat what you're speaking of.
Yeah, I mean, I think great works of art are in many ways the same. The same, and I mean, we're used to thinking so much on visual arts as it looks this way or looks that way, but once you move that out of the way and you have the experience of a great work of art, and you look at Leonardo or Giorgione, or you look at Manet, and you stand in front of them, the kind of light that comes from this work is quite similar, even though the embodiment of them may be quite different. And the reason why it's different is because in order to channel that light, Manet, as an 19th century person, have to handle things very differently than Velázquez working in the 1600s. But the light itself is quite similar. And it is that light ultimately that is art. That's what art it really is.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we were talking about the kind of precious naming of works of art and things like that. And I think that if one has to really explain what a piece of art is, then it's failed, in my opinion. And I think that with a lot of the shock art, that's where the public kind of faith in art, certainly in Britain, I think a lot of people just felt very lost about what art meant anymore, because it's like they had to read 10 books and, you know, before they could stand in front of it and know what it was or feel it. Whereas my opinion is that you should feel something in front of a great work of art without knowing anything. Would you agree with that, or is that too black and white?
Well, I mean, usually the problem is the 10 books you have to read to understand the work of art are not very good books. I think if you have to read, you know, 2 Dostoevsky books and 2 Tolstoy books to feel something about a work of art, you probably would not be that bad.
No.
But if what you have to read is some sort of pontificating, justifying, relatively superficial pieces of writing that are very topical to the ideas that may be fashionable at a particular moment in time, then that reading always seems to be no much more than a prop.
Yes.
So that being said, in the same way that, for example, I can encounter you and have a direct experience with you without any knowledge of your history, and I get an information about you, I get a feeling about you. If I knew other things about you, if I knew your history, if I knew where you come from and all of that, I will have different points of entry into who you are.
Yeah.
So I'll be able to experience you maybe differently. But So it doesn't mean that I cannot experience you without that knowledge, but that I will have a different experience if I have that knowledge. So if you look at, say, a painting by Velázquez of Philip IV, you might have a different relationship to it if you knew a lot about Velázquez, a lot of Philip IV, a lot about their relationship.
Yeah.
And now you have a different point of entry, but it is not necessary to confront a work of art that is that is transformative. But ultimately, art is a knowledge of sorts, and that knowledge comes through experiencing. So demanding that, say, you don't, if I don't think all day long, I have a job and I never think about art and I never think of what it does, and one day I encounter a work of art and I demand and expect that this thing that I never thought about before will do something for me, that's also an irrational expectation. Any more than if I are not used to looking and say, the concerns of a journalist and what makes a great piece of journalism versus just a trivial one. Mm. And I never thought about it. I never read any news. Mm. And one day I come in and open a piece of journalism, I'm supposed to be able to deconstruct all the assumptions underneath that article or the validity of it. That would be arrogant for me to say that with no preparation and no history and no relationship, I should be able to discern what's good from what's not good.
Yeah.
So I think that we do need exposure and thinking and engagement. Mm. I mean, I think about my work 12 hours a day, and I've been doing it since I was pretty young. Mm. So somebody stands in front of the work and say, well, I don't get it. Well, for me, the first 7 months that I was working on that painting, I didn't get it either.
Mm.
And I was looking at it for a long time.
Yeah.
So that somebody doesn't get it in the first 5 minutes, it's like, yeah, that's okay.
Mm.
How much longer do you want to give it? But there are usually people that want to give it more. So if it doesn't pay, it doesn't reward me within the first 5 minutes, I'm moving on.
Mm.
And that's, you know, there's something odd about that.
Yes. Yeah. That's a good distinction to make, I think. And it's part of the problem with people just increasingly with social media being in echo chambers, you know, of if that's all you're hearing and understanding, then, like you say, you're going to be limited in how you can understand something really outside of your experience. You're also a writer, and some of your paintings incorporate writing. I'm wondering how you see the relationship between your writing and your visual art.
I mean, in many ways, I see no distinction between them. I know that sounds nonsensical, but I am writing, in particular, poetry. And now I'm not talking about my poetry, but the poets that are who I admire. When I see their work, when I hear certain sounds, or when I feel how deeply they're moving things out of the way to get to something that resonates within me, I recognize in that the same things I recognize in painting, I recognize in art, and then in my own work, some things are better manifested as words and some things are manifested as images, but the preoccupations and the desires and the urgency behind them is the same one.
Mm.
So to an extent, I sometimes feel that I'm trying to make visual arts that feel like poems and poems that feel like visual art in some manner.
Where your work features figures, they're usually male rather than female. I'm wondering if you can tell me a bit about that.
You know, they are occasionally females, but some aspect of my work, even though I have often denied it, has a biographical component to it. Mm. I think that there's definitely that. I always feel there's more theatricality when I put a female, partly because I am right now forced to invent more because it wasn't my experience.
Mm.
So I have two daughters. So whenever I put a female in them I've used them and the thought of them and the thought of their heart or their feelings about things to project those into my work. So it has been easier to put females into my work since I had my daughters than it was before.
Mm.
That being said, you know, they do appear occasionally, girls and occasionally women.
If we think of them in terms of inner archetypes rather than external figures, do you ever think of it in that way, in terms of putting male or female figures in your art? Something coming from within you, you know, the masculine or feminine, on that sort of more psychic level?
Sure. I mean, I think many of the females that have appeared, I mean, thinking off the top of my head, this painting I made for Berlin in 2004. There was a girl with a broken stone from which water was coming out, and I remember feeling very much a connection with that girl as something that was familiar within me. So there is that way of working, although my work have often been described in terms of archetypal references just because the images are so basic, you know, trees or water or figures, very, very familiar and sort of a deep connection with deep parts of our brain. That being said, I never sort of look at it in a sort of a symbolic way of an archetype, which I preconceived beforehand and stated to tell a story. It's too, that is too constructed and too distant and too planned out to work for me. I think the works have to emerge from a more direct way that is not the construction of archetypes, like I opened Jung, Man and His Symbols, and I pick this and pick that and stuff to construct a story. I could never work like that. It has to seem truer and more inevitable than something I construct like that.
And I suppose if we think of how archetypes operate, then often they're operating on an unconscious level, so they may be appearing in your paintings without, you know, you consciously deciding on it.
Yeah. But I think that's fine. I mean, I think when they're inevitably, and I hope that they are appearing in their work in a very sort of deep sense of awareness, but not something that one seek out a bunch of myths and a bunch of archetypes which actually many artists do, to create something that had the appearance of gravitas or appearance of something deeply connected with, when in fact is manipulative, in my opinion.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my conversation with special guest, artist and author Enrique Martinez Celaya. And if you just joined us, this is the second in a series of three conversations that I had with Enrique at his studio in Los Angeles. If you missed the first one, if you go to the show website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, and you go to the guest page, you'll be able to find the podcast there. And then do look out in coming weeks for the last part of this series. We're going to go to a break now, but I'll be back with more of our conversation after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel, and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda Yoga class is always free. Visit us at AnandaScottsValley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's AnandaScottsValley.org or 338-YOGA.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my conversation with my special guest from the arts this week, artist and author Enrique Martinez Celaya, whom I spoke to at his studio in Los Angeles. So let's hear the last part of our conversation.
Gilbert said that writing was closer to thinking than speaking. I'm wondering what you think about that, and also how you would think of that in terms of visual art, whether that is closer in some ways to the way we think.
You know, I'm not sure what the distinction between thinking and feeling and experiencing really is. Where are the boundaries between those things?
Yeah.
I think that a lot of what people call thinking has the quality of feeling. A lot of people call feeling has a quality of thinking, and some things are experiential, which are neither thinking nor feeling.
Yeah.
So I try to avoid those words altogether just because I find them, they're so complicated. But I think writing for me is some sort of invocation of sorts. It opens up a space that has the texture of feeling, but also have the texture of thought and the texture, the texture of the remembered or something.
Mm-hmm.
And in that space there, I feel that truth is somewhere, even if elusive.
Mm.
And I think that's the same space I'm constantly trying to open up in paintings and trying to pull paintings away from that decorative place they often want to go to.
Mm.
You know, I don't think of artwork ever as production, for example, which is a common word used for it, or as having a function within a particular discourse. I'd rather think of them as more as and in themselves, connected to the preoccupations that one sees in a poem like Czesław Miłosz or Frost or Jeffers or something like that. And I think, well, that's what I want, is engage with the unconcealment of reality, not with anything having to do with culture.
Mm. You have an interesting cultural and experiential background. I'm wondering how much of the power of art comes from translating the personal into something universal.
Well, I mean, I don't think of them as a translation. So most of the things that I pursued of that one will describe as personal are really fundamentally questions. Like, I find myself moving through life, and just about, not everything, but a lot of things that I encounter are really questions to me. I look at it and I find myself asking, who am I in relationship to that? What is that?
Mm.
How does it come to be? And in pursuing those questions, I think that I hit upon the questions that many of us have, and in that sense, it becomes universal in some manner. The work is often the images that I use or the concerns I have. Is I think they perhaps start with me in the sense that it is me who is engaging them or a biographical point, but they don't end in me. They're not confessions. I think confessions in some ways is begin and end with yourself. And I'm interested in something that perhaps the concern begins with me but ends beyond me.
Mm.
And And that's not so much a process of translation as it is a process of empathy and communion and relationship. I mean, when I see a work of art or a piece of literature that I'm moved by, it's because in it I recognize an aspect of myself that maybe an aspect of myself that was lost until I encountered this work. And now I realize that I have been missing that part for a while.
Mm. Yeah. There are indications that participation in art can have tangible positive effects. I myself designed and conducted a funded clinical research study into the effects of the arts on the performance, creativity, health and well-being of senior business executives, which showed positive correlations. And there's a psychologist I really admire, Alice Miller. I don't know if you're familiar with her, who studied artists in depth, Picasso, Nietzsche, and considered art could help process trauma. I'm wondering if you feel that art can have a healing effect, both on those making art and also those experiencing it.
I mean, in my experience and what I have seen, I have seen both things. Mm-hmm. I have seen art. Art is a very demanding, some people have called it demanding mistress, but, you know, I think that's a male perspective, but certainly a demanding companion, for sure.
In terms of making art.
In terms of being an artist, I mean, art is willing to always take as much as you're willing to give it.
Mm.
So every second of your life, art will be willing to take.
Mm.
Every relationship can easily become secondary to art.
Mm.
So to an extent, art could be like the worst habit you can possibly take on, and also the constant collision with your own limitations, with your own insufficiency, with your own mediocrity, can really drive anybody, you know, completely crazy. I mean, if you're feeling really good about yourself, all you have to do is try to make a painting, and that will immediately set your standards where you really should be. On the other hand, it is true that certainly the way I approach painting, I'm trying to understand life better. And if I didn't have painting or art to do that, or writing to do that, I would be much worse off. I will, life will make a lot less meaning than it does. I mean, it's not like I understand things very well now, but I would understand them better than I would without art and literature in my life. So I think in my own specific case, even though sometimes I am very conscious of that infinite demand next to me, I'm grateful for what it had done to my life, how it had put my life in some sort of continuum with the world. Art has done this. It has made me think that there is something to life and to living other than money or positions or titles or popularity. And I think I'm grateful for that very much. And I'm grateful for the incredible mental sanity of being able to spend time and have the gift of being able to be lucky enough to spend my time thinking about things that matter, as opposed to things that somebody else thinks that matter, or you know, moving paper around or something like that. I'm grateful that I get to ask questions that I think are important, and I feel lucky every day for being able to do that. So I accept this sort of infinite demand, demanding companion next to me, because it's a companion that has guided me and made me feel less lonely.
Yeah, a film director, Mark Pellington, I interviewed, he said that great art makes you feel less alone.
Yeah.
And segueing from that, I think experiencing great art also can make one feel less alone. And
sure.
How would you see the relationship, the healing, potentially positive relationship of experiencing art as opposed to making it?
Yeah, I mean, that to me is an easier relationship to explain. I mean, I think I am so incredibly grateful for the books and the artworks that I've experienced in my life. My life would be significantly poorer, less dimensional, and less rich at a very deep level without the opportunity I've had to read the books I have read and to encounter the works I have encountered. And they have changed me, and they have reminded me that I am not alone, that some of the concerns I have other people have had. The humanity conveyed by say the death of Ivan Illich or something like that, a book like that, or the rumbling of darkness underneath the poems of Robert Frost connect me to larger continuums other than myself. It made me less self-preoccupied. It broadened my concerns beyond my own immediate business or problems or issues.
Yeah. If worldly acclaim and financial success aren't completely reliable indications, how should an artist judge the success of their work in their own eyes?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I think that I'm not sure how to judge the success of my work other than I can judge the success of the activity of making my work. I can judge, that I have tried to remain faithful to what I think, what I say, and what I do are the same, that I have while failing quite often, I have tried to make sure that I hold myself in the road of those people who admire, even if I'm far down the road, but at least that road is the one that I want to be on. And in those ways, I can judge the effort as worthwhile and meaningful and true or not, even if there are ups and downs there in terms of my ability and willingness to do that. But in the work itself, it's very difficult to judge success because any time that you compare your work to the work you admire, you cannot possibly be impressed with what you have done. I mean, people who are impressed with themselves, they don't know too much. Because if you know just even a little bit, you cannot be that impressed with yourself. No. So it's very difficult to look at your work and say, wow, this is really good. I mean, who can possibly say that with a straight face if you know works that you really respect? So, and I'm not just being modest. I think that that is difficult to judge from that standpoint. So the only thing I can control and judge ultimately is the engagement, the effort, the activity.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Well, thanks again there to Enrique Martinez-Salaya for making the time to talk to me at his studio in LA. As I mentioned, this interview is one of a three-part series of conversations with Enrique, so look out for the concluding part in coming weeks. And if you'd like to hear the first conversation, if you go to the show website, it's a question of balance.com, and click on the guests page, you'll be able to find that there. And also, if you want to listen to some of the interesting topics that we've covered, click on the topics page. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to you being with me again next time.